This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Many Americans were outraged when they saw the photos of abused detainees at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq in 2004. Photos showed prisoners naked, piled up in hallways, and covered with their own feces. There was more. The Bush administration claimed it was only a few bad military and intelligence officers who committed these abuses. The facility housed thousands of Iraqi detainees who were interrogated about Saddam Hussein's regime. Eric Fair was a contract interrogator at Abu Ghraib prison, who was not involved in the photographed abuse, but he says he is haunted by his role in the interrogation program at Abu Ghraib. His new book is called Consequence, a Memoir. Eric Fair shares his story at a free talk later today at Duke University, sponsored by the Forum for Scholars and Publics, but he is with me on The State of Things now. Eric Fair, welcome. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about a little bit about growing up, because you spend some time on that in your book. You grew up in a Presbyterian family in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and you say that that in many ways, your religious upbringing had a lot to do with sort of your mindset and how you would get involved in this kind of project.
Yeah, so as you said, I grew up a Presbyterian, and one of the really important tenets of the Presbyterian faith is the sense of a calling, and you're to identify really quickly kind of where God is calling you, and not just whether or not you're going to be an ordained pastor in the church, but really any kind of vocation. And so early on, for a number of different reasons, I sensed at then what I was defining a calling towards law enforcement, so I wanted to be a police officer. And as I grew up and as I, you know, I went to college and I continued to pursue that, the easiest way to get into kind of any local police department was with veterans preference. This was in the early 1990s. Police departments weren't necessarily hiring. And so that the Army for me was really kind of a means to an end. So I enlisted in 1995. It was not a time of war. The Gulf War was in the rearview mirror at this point. There were operations in Kosovo, but, you know, not ground combat. Based on some test scores, they sent me to a school to learn Arabic, and I gained a security clearance. And when 2000 rolled around, my enlistment had run up, and so I took my discharge. There didn't seem to be any reason for an Arabic linguist to be in the military at that point. There wasn't much going on. And so I did. I came home, became a policeman. And so eventually, after 9/11 and in the run-up to the invasion, I felt an obligation to be a part of that war. Some of my friends were there. I had supported the initial invasion, and I felt like that meant I needed to be involved.
So how did you come to the contract group CACI that eventually hired you? How did you find out about them and decide that was for you?
So I when I left the police job, and I actually lost the police job because of a heart condition. So I lost it because of a medical condition. So I could not reenlist in the military. And so I took a job with the National Security Agency, and I was with them only for a week or two, and someone had started to mention that these contracting companies were looking for people to go over to Iraq. Now, as an employee of the NSA, it likely would have taken me a year or two to get through some of the training programs before I deployed. And we thought, this was actually in December of 2003, we thought the war would be over soon. And, you know, Saddam Hussein was captured, and we really kind of sensed that that was the end of it. And again, as a soldier, and I'm not proud of this, but you know, I felt kind of a sense of calling to be involved in that war. And so I wanted to get there as fast as I could before it ended.
You got some advice from somebody at the NSA not to get involved with these contractors.
Yeah, not just at the NSA, but people I'd served with either in the police departments or in the Army, that contracting was really kind of not the honorable way to go about this. And that, and they were right. I didn't know much about contracting at that point, and neither did the rest of the country. But they were looking for interrogators. There was a shortage of people willing to process prisoners. And they hired me without an interview, without me ever going down to Arlington to their headquarters. I resigned my position with the NSA, and I was in Iraq within about 2 weeks.
What were you write about this and say that the guy who did the interview with you didn't spend much time. He seemed preoccupied. Then he found out that you were ex-military, an ex-police officer, and you had survival training, and that seemed to just turn on a whole.
Yeah. So I originally had actually been hired by CACI as an intelligence analyst, and it was like you said, when he went through my resume and found that I had been a police officer and I had some training in the military, language training, and some other schools. That I qualified. The contractors had to find a way to justify assigning people to different positions. And so the Army, which was the customer, had to sort of sign off on that. And so CACI was able to sort of list my resume, my bullet points, and say, here is someone who qualifies as an interrogator. They did not make any of this stuff up, right? These were things that I'd done. And so the Army, the Department of Defense, signed off on that as me being a qualified interrogator.
So what were you thinking? Were you expecting to be an interrogator? What were you thinking was going to happen? Or what were the other possibilities for you at CACI?
Well, as an intelligence, I'd been an intelligence specialist in the Army. And so I certainly spent time with interrogators and I knew about the interrogation program. And my impression, and I think everyone's impression, that it had a lot more to do with debriefing. And so you would bring prisoners back to the rear and you'd debrief them about what units they had been in, how the level of morale, their uniforms, the kinds of equipment they had. So it was kind of a question and answer sort of thing. The situation I eventually ended up in was actually far more law enforcement based, this idea of guilt or innocence. Is this someone who's working against American forces or with? Quite frankly, no one, no matter how much interrogation experience you may have had, and there wasn't much, no one was prepared for what was going to come.
Tell us about Abu Ghraib. When you first got there, what did you see and how did you feel about it?
Yeah, well, so two very distinct different questions there, what I saw and what I felt. What I saw are things that, you can find pictures of Abu Ghraib on the internet and get a good sense. A large prison complex, walled with a number of different prison buildings inside. But it was more about what we felt and seeing the prisoners for the first time in outdoor camps, just the sheer number. And it's hard for me even to kind of – I'm not even sure how many there were at the time, probably 3 to 5,000. And so the idea that we were imprisoning Iraqis in their own country in a place like Abu Ghraib, even before we get to this talk about interrogation or torture, just the idea of imprisoning so many people during war in their own country was clearly going to create issues and was morally suspect.
You had some very young people behind bars there too.
Yeah, the vast majority were young males, but there was certainly, age was often difficult to determine in Iraq. They don't keep track, or many of them don't keep track of their birthdays the way that we would. They would call them young men, but they were clearly boys, yeah. And there were a mix of old men as well.
All right. So, what were your assignments? You actually, I think the very opening of the book, you talk about one particular room that was set aside for sort of gaining the confidence of the prisoners there. And you write that story, I think, pretty well. I think it's pretty telling. Maybe you can describe it.
So there's an interrogation technique called change of scenery. And the idea is that you remove a prisoner from the idea of a prison camp and put them somewhere that makes them kind of feel at ease. And in this case, there was one interrogation room that had comfortable chairs and you could serve tea and you could have sort of a conversation and hoping to sort of trick them into thinking that they were at their office or some other place. And this was an older gentleman. He'd been a high-ranking officer in the military. And so this, again, it was just one of the techniques that we used. And again, the idea that you would trick anyone into not recognizing where they were in terms of being in Abu Ghraib and not hearing the mortar rounds come in and the rockets come in.
You talked about this, but you realized that you were fooling yourself. I mean, there's a guy, you're thinking, I'm just going to make him think I'm my friend. And like he's an idiot, like he's not playing you the same way, right?
Well, yeah, and I don't know that he was necessarily playing me as I was playing myself. We were desperate in some ways to justify what was going on, right? So, the issue of interrogation is morally suspect just from the start, where you're essentially forcing someone to talk to you, even before you get to the ideas of manipulating someone. And so that it was difficult for me to, while I still felt committed to the mission, I knew in the very beginning that I was wrong. And so this idea of kind of this comfortable chair and making the tea and speaking to this guy about sort of daily issues, I fooled myself into thinking that I was still kind of a reasonable person and I had something to be proud of.
Well, you talked about the issue of interrogation itself being morally suspect. If we have men and women under arms, personnel under arms, and they're in harm's way, don't we have a responsibility to find out what we can that would be called, I think what the term is, actionable intelligence?
No, we do not have that responsibility. We have in the theater of war, we have a responsibility to take prisoners and move them back to the rear and make sure they're safe. Right. Some of the most powerful images for me from the first Gulf War were the scenes of Iraqi soldiers running towards American lines and surrendering en masse. Right. And this idea that they knew that they were going to be safer with American troops than they were within their own units. And that was kind of that idealistic image, naive that it may be, was kind of the image that I had. And it's the kind of image we need to project. If we take prisoners in a time of war, we need to move them into a safe place and we need to make sure they're cared for and well fed, well clothed. And if at some point they want to cooperate with us or there's something they want to talk about, that's fine. And that's where the role of something like debriefing and interrogation and interview comes in. But no, we do not have an obligation to gain intelligence information from other human beings.
It certainly wasn't the policy at the time. What kinds of techniques and tactics were going on there? And so tell us about the techniques that were used that you think may have crossed the line.
Yeah, I've been speaking about this for about 10 years, and you know, I can list sort of the techniques, and they're out there. And for many years, I would talk about some of these techniques like stress positions, and people would kind of laugh it off as not being torture or not having happened at all. But we know over the course of the last 10 years that this stuff was it was happening on a daily basis. Stress positions were really the most common form of torture. And sleep deprivation in particular. And there's been this long discussion about what sleep deprivation is, and, oh, I went to basic training and I was sleep deprived, or I'm a medical school student, and that's nonsense. Sleep deprivation can be accomplished in a matter of hours. You take a prisoner, put them into a dark room with no windows, let them sleep for an hour, wake them up. They don't know how long they've been asleep. Let them go back to sleep and repeat that. And over the course of a few hours, you can have them lose track of time, and they almost immediately lose track of hope. So sleep deprivation is absolutely torture, and it's not something that takes weeks or months.
There was a detailed piece in the New York Times that talks about the long-term effects. Now, they're looking at Guantanamo Bay, detainees that were held there. Many of them were wrongly accused in the first place. Long-term psychological disabilities now as a result, when the CIA and others were telling us this would not happen, that these only have short-term effects. So even if you're uncomfortable depriving someone of sleep, it won't have long-term effects. And it turns out that is simply not true.
Yeah, well, and I want to address even a word that you're using there, detainee, and it's a word that continues to be in my own vocabulary, and I try to eliminate it. They're not detainees, right? As a police officer, I detained people. If someone were drunk on the street, I would detain them on the sidewalk until I could reasonably release them or find a place for them. We don't detain people in a war. They are prisoners. They are taken prisoner. And they are not detained for 10 minutes or 10 days. They are detained for or prisoners for years. And so any idea that you could take someone and imprison them, which is already kind of a stressful sort of environment in the theater of war, even if you do it as humanely as possible, there's stress involved. And then in any way you introduce any kind of outside stress and call it something like enhanced or advanced, which is clearly torture, there are clearly going to be not long-term effects, but permanent effects on those people.
It's interesting because one of the things you were looking for in 2004, a big area of focus was chemical weapons, right? Was that the...
That's right, yeah.
The interesting thing about that is that those chemical weapons, it turns out, if you're asking where they are, they existed in the imagination of Dick Cheney because they didn't. And so here you are looking for something that doesn't exist and using these techniques. But here's my question. You sound pretty sure about how wrong this is now. How'd you feel about it then, and why did you do it?
Well, the connection for me to the military was a strong one. And I can go back in some ways to growing up as a devout Presbyterian. My connection to the church, I was protected by the Presbyterian church. You know, men that had worked for the steel company in Bethlehem called me by my first name and kind of treated me with respect. And so I felt at home in that community. The Army was similar in terms, you know, one of the interesting things about the Army is that the leaders eat last. And so if you line up for chow out in the field, the leaders have to make sure that they have enough food for everyone in the unit. And so I sensed kind of that same kind of community. And it was powerful. And in some ways, that's a good thing. I'm not anti-military. I'm not anti-Army. I think it's a good institution. But again, the idea that... And this is difficult for me because, all these years on, it seems obvious even to me. And so I want to kind of release myself and say that, you know, I did know better. But that the pull towards not quitting on your friends and not quitting on that unit was so strong. And I know this is difficult to understand, but that something even as obvious, you see the photographs and it looks so obvious, it was not obvious then. I wish it was. You know, we didn't show up. Even all these years later, you can hear me struggling over this. I don't have a good answer for that, and it's something I'm not proud of. But I can tell you that the people that are involved in these kind of things are not necessarily sort of evil or are going to come home and do these kind of things to each other. It was just a natural process that it was really difficult to avoid.
I wonder how much we should know about this. You have certainly told all this story in your book. Senator Richard Burr, a Republican from North Carolina, is also the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He put a stop on releasing the full report, the full Senate report on CIA dark sites and torture. Yeah. There was a summary that has been released, a 500-page summary. The 6,700-page report by Senator Burr has kept from public view.
Sure.
Should we release that, or are there things, because what he said is, look, that only embarrasses the Bush administration. It's a political document. It's not going to help us. Those 6,700 pages of torture by the CIA and the techniques we shouldn't know about that.
Yeah, well, and I think if you're already cemented in your view of that, you're not going to change. For me, the simple answer is yes, of course, we should release that. I mean we're a democracy, and we run on information and knowing the truth and not being misled by propaganda. The idea that we would either only release half of it or not at all is really kind of the definition of propaganda. But I think there's also another thing at stake there, and I think about your previous guest talking about the power of photographs and images, and he talked one point about sort of opening the luggage and kind of could smell that time that they were there and how powerful that emotion was. And so I think that no matter how much we release and no matter how many documents are exposed, no matter how many photographs that we look at, there's always going to be a disconnect between what was really going on there and what sort of Americans believe. I spoke to a class this morning at Duke University, and we talked about that, and someone had asked, how do we get involved in this? How do we change people's minds? And I think really the only way is to be there and is to find a way either to join the military or join nonprofits or NGOs. And, the country's at war on a number of different fronts, and I think we have an obligation as citizens to be there. And that's how we're going to kind of spread what's really or understand what's really going on.
They were shocking to at least some of us when we saw those photographs, and horrifying to at least some of us when we saw those photographs. But that was 12 years ago. I know you go around to high schools now and talk to kids who, weren't watching the TV.
Right. Yeah.
So what's that like? Do we have a sense that we have done this as a nation and we need to, sort of resolve never to do it again? Or?
Yeah, I remember growing up as a boy and seeing photos from Vietnam, and in particular the young girl who had just suffered burns from napalm. And I remember seeing the images and other images too from Vietnam and World War II and recognizing that these are bad images and terrible things, but also being in some ways kind of drawn to the experience and recognizing in some way that if this was something that that for some reason I'm interested in seeing in this, and I'm young enough that I don't understand why, this is something that I should want to be a part of. So, I talk about this with students all the time who are were either not born or were very young at the time of those images, and if they haven't seen them. And if I show them to them, I can tell that the reaction is not a true, honest reaction to what the actual experience was. And so it's difficult. We certainly don't want to sweep that under the rug, and I'm not suggesting that we get rid of those images. But I'm not sure that no matter how many images you see, and in some ways they may even have a numbing effect, I don't know that it's going to make a difference.
Eric Farah, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for the time.
Eric Farah, former interrogator at Abu Ghraib Prison. His new book is called Consequence, a memoir. He speaks today at an event sponsored by the Forum for Scholars and Publics at Duke University. It's 4 o'clock. We have details at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.